again and again in their depiction of Jesus, the Gospels insist on his single-minded attention, his wholehearted responsiveness to God. There are many sayings I could cite. When Jesus was asked, which is the greatest commandment? He replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. Commenting on his disciples' worry about what they would eat or drink or wear, he exhorted them to strive first for the kingdom of God and God's righteousness. And in response to Martha's agitation about her many tasks, he commended Mary's choice to listen quietly at his feet. For, he said, there is need of only one thing. As we've just heard in our reading, it's clear that Jesus practiced what he preached. Faced at the outset of his public ministry with the temptation to live and act out of his own will and resource, Jesus consistently refused that option. He came back again and again to deep listening to every word that comes from the mouth of God. He practiced radical trust in God's provision and the complete letting go of egoic ambition to succeed in or change the world. Everything was yielded to God, until eventually the temptation to seize his life apart from God dried up and an energy of a wholly different quality suffused him. As Matthew puts it, then the devil left him, and suddenly angels came and waited on him. This is what contemplation is about. Through practice that leads beyond the egoic temptation to run life on our terms, contemplation draws us towards the possibility of sharing in the very relationship with God that Jesus knew. This is a relationship ultimately of communion or at-one-ment. God's life living itself in ours. God's love flowing out through ours. Contemplation is about realizing the gift Jesus sought on his disciples' behalf. As you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that they may be one as we are one. Well, Kerry Hyde puts it this way. Contemplation loses the sense of looking at God reflexively as subjective, objective knowing that we know, and becomes beholding in total awareness of God or oneness with God. In contemplation, we are absorbed within the loving of divine contemplation, within love's oneness. Well, as I said, today we have the great privilege of launching Kerry's book, though it's, I think, well launched elsewhere. But anyway, here we're launching Love's Oneness, a book about contemplation. I found this text an incredibly rich reflection. There it is. Steeped in the practice and transfiguring knowledge of which it speaks. There are, as Kerry notes, a growing number of excellent books about contemplation and many introductions to the practice of meditation. What's different about this book, however, is that it's written expressly with mature contemplatives in mind, those who are already steeped in the central movements of the contemplative journey, but who, quote, seek more nuanced wisdom on how to nurture heart awareness and discern and foster a more stable contemplation. We might be hesitant to identify ourselves as mature contemplatives, but it's a book addressed at least to the journey that many of us are on. And I hope I can give you even a small glimpse of its bounteous resource. The key image in Love's Oneing is oneing. It's a word that comes from the 14th century English contemplative Julian of Norwich, who says that prayer ones the soul to God. What's striking about the verb oneing is that it expresses a sense of the vital, dynamic process of becoming one with God, as well as the centering, grounding, and abiding at one-ment of the soul in God. Kerry notes that the classic definitions of oneing as being joined or united fall short of conveying the original creative dynamism and fluidity of the oneing that is Trinitarian love. The communion of love that constitutes God, the unity that God is not a static or self-enclosed identity, but an ever-fertile movement of love pouring itself out and receiving itself back. And this has profound implications, I think, for how we imagine our contemplative journeys. Because we're not striving one day to arrive at an end, to get there and possess our spiritual achievement. Rather, we're being drawn into an eternal dynamism of love, which Kerry insists is simultaneously enstatic, that is, enclosing, still, abiding, and ecstatic, outpouring, creative, evolutionary. In the Christian imagination, this oneing in love is conceived as an enchristing journey. In other words, it's how we come to share the mind of Christ, or awaken Christ consciousness. And crucially, this affects not just the possibilities of our own lives, but the unfolding of life itself. The final three chapters of Kerry's book explore the thought of three more or less contemporary mystics, Teilhard de Chardin, Beatrice Brutot, and Ilya Dalio, whose conviction is that the rise of oneing consciousness within us is connected to the emergence of communion consciousness between us. A gestalt shift in our whole way of seeing and being in relation with one another. And Kerry writes that this communion consciousness naturally imparts a greater awareness of our wholeness, including all of ourselves, all of creation, and the whole cosmic expression. The energy of oneing heightens, imparting deeper union, stronger connectivity, and fuller being. And this profound realization of what Kerry calls our holy wholeness is critical for responding to the needs of our time, not just because it awakens us to a radically interrelated cosmos, but because the energy of oneing in us flows out to affect the whole. The invitation for us is to be the creative union, to be this field of oneing, to be the flow of love energy, the creative freedom that self creates. And Kerry asks, can we be the oneing that creates communion and awakens communion consciousness? Well, can we? How do we accept the invitation to be one by, with, and in love? Each chapter of Kerry's book explores the life and thought of a mystic from the Western tradition. There are 9 in all. And each one insists that the essence of the contemplative journey is the movement of kenosis, which means self-emptying, dispossession, the old word naughting, becoming not naughty, but naught, yielding self-preoccupation and defensiveness, leaving self behind. But there are nuances in the teachings of these figures. This idea of kenosis is common to them all, but there were nuances in the teachings, subtle shifts in emphasis that we do well to attend to and learn from. For example, Julian of Norwich encourages the movement of kenosis through the practice of what she calls beholding. For Julian herself, beholding began when she was suffering from what had seemed a mortal illness and was handed a crucifix to gaze upon. She looked upon the wounded Christ, and gradually her seeing deepened, so that, as she writes, in seeing a bodily sight of his bleeding form, she simultaneously sees a spiritual sight of Christ's homely loving. In other words, progressing from bodily beholding, she begins to see with the eye of the heart. And this deeper beholding draws her onto the inside of that which she beholds. As Kerry puts it, beholding is intrinsically kenotic, as it involves emptying ourselves of all conceptualizations as we pour out our heart in love. Beholding transforms us into the subject of our beholding. Kerry's next mystic, the author of The Cloud of Unknowing, also speaks of beholding, but with an emphasis on the stirring of desire, the role of eros and longing love in drawing us to God. This desire, however, must be profoundly non-possessive, a longing beyond longing, a naked intent. So this too is a kenotic way that displaces the attachments of the egoic self and serves to invite his readers into a naked, spacious, formless abandon, until in silence and stillness, beholding blindly, we are one to God in love. Meister Eckhart, in the next chapter, speaks of listening in silence and cultivating a bare mind, an inner desert, an emptiness, a bareness, a poverty of being that enables us to be pregnant with nothing. While Claire of Assisi, Mechthild of Magdeburg, and John of the Cross allow themselves to enter deeply into the wounds of Christ, undergoing with him the suffering of the world, so as to discover at the very extremity of pain the unity of intimacy of divine love. In all this, we see the significance of the fact that this book is addressed to those who are maturing in contemplation. As long as we're unschooled in the basic discipline of letting go spiritual materialism, as long as we're still trying to have spiritual experiences that might make us feel special or secure or holy, all this language could be misread, misappropriated, as if we're supposed to try to generate certain feelings, certain internal dramas of the soul. But what's been spoken of here is subtler. The metaphorical, paradoxical, sometimes extravagant language of mystical texts is an expression of the unfolding of a long journey, different for each of us, that begins, as it did for Jesus in the Gospel, with the simple commitment to put God at the centre of things and to give up the impulse to clutch at what can only ultimately be given. This is a book that needs to be prayed more than read. There are, in fact, invitations to pray at the end of each chapter, but that's not all I mean. Kerry's prose itself is designed to slow us down and draw us into the space of prayer, which she describes as an open-hearted receptivity, an interior silence, and a preparedness to pour out love in naughting to the point where we lose ourselves in the one. What a gift to be offered at the beginning of Lent. May it be a blessing to all to whom it finds its way.